If you were there in early January, you would see bigger bonfires, ones built of discarded Christmas trees, so dry and flammable they exploded on the high pyres. After each explosion, you might have heard us cheer. When I say us, I mean us WPODs. We loved life more than the future. White Punks on Dope is just some song. We didn't even listen to it. The acronym was something else. Not a gang, but a grouping, an attitude, a way of dressing, living, being. Some changed our graffiti to white powder on donuts. And many of us were not even white, which becomes harder to explain. Because the whole world of the Sunset WPODs was about white power, not powder. But these were the beliefs of not powerful kids who might end up passing through rehab centers and jails unless they were the chosen few, the very few girls and boys who, respectively, either enrolled in the DeLue School of Beauty or got hired at John John Roofing on 9th Avenue between Irving and Lincoln. When I was little, I saw a cover of an old magazine that showed the robes and feet of people who had drunk the Kool-Aid Jim Jones handed out in Guyana. My entire childhood, I would think of that image and feel bad. I once told Jimmy Darling, and he said it wasn't actually Kool-Aid, it was High C. What kind of person would want to clarify such a thing? A smartass is who? A person who is safe from that image in a way I was not. I was not likely to join a cult. That was not the danger I felt in glimpsing the feet of the dead, the bucket from which they drank. It was the proven fact in the photographed feet that you could drink death and join it. When I was 5 or 6 years old, I saw a paperback cover in the supermarket that was a drawing of a woman, and her nude body had two knives coming out of it, blood pooling around her. The cover of the book said, "Killed Twice." That was its title. I was away from my mother, who was shopping somewhere in the market. We were at Park and Shop on Irving, and I felt I was not just a few aisles away, but permanently sucked out to sea, to the engulfing world of Killed Twice. Coming home from the market, I was nauseous. I could not eat the dinner my mother prepared. She didn't really cook. It was probably top ramen she prepared for me, and then attended to whichever of the men she was dating at the time. For years, whenever I thought of that image on the cover of Killed Twice, I felt sick. Now I can see that what I experienced was normal. You learn when you're young that evil exists. You absorb the knowledge of it. When this happens for the first time, it does not go down easy. It goes down like a horse pill. At age 10, I fell under the spell of an older girl named Tyra. She had glassy eyes and olive skin and a husky, tough girl voice. The night I met her, I was in someone's car, driving around drinking Löwenbräu Lights. Lowy Lights, green bottles with a baby blue label. We picked up Tyra on Noriega, at a house that was an informal foster home for girls. The man who ran it, Russ, forced himself on the girls at night, unpredictably but predictably. If you stayed there, sooner or later you were going to be visited at night by Russ, who was old and muscular and mean. The girls complained about being raped by him as if it were a form of strictness or rent. They were willing to endure it because they didn't have other options. The rest of us did nothing about it because Russ bought us liquor, and what were we to do, call the police? One of them was known for taking girls out to Point Lobos instead of to the police station on Taravelle. Tyra called shotgun in a menacing way and got in the front, put her feet on the dash. She was already buzzed, she told us, slurring her words in a way I found glamorous. She wore diamond earrings. They flashed from her little girl ears as she drained a lowy light and pitched her empty from the window of the car. Maybe Tyra's earrings were fakes. It didn't matter. Their effect was the same. For me, she had the magic. That year, I'd had a chance to know a nice girl with two parents, middle class. She came to my house for a sleepover. The next week at school, she told everyone that at my house, we ate hostess pies for dinner and threw the wrappers under the bed. I have no memory of that. I'm not saying it isn't true. My mom let me eat what I wanted for dinner. She was usually with whatever guy she was seeing, someone who didn't like children, so they'd be shut up in her bedroom with the door locked. We had an account at the corner market, and I'd go down there and get goodies, chips, liters of soda, whatever I wanted. I didn't know to pretend to live some other way to make an impression on another kid. It made me sad what this girl said about me and about our house. I was sad even as I stuck a pin in her ass as she got off the 6th Parnassus after school, stood by the back doors, and as she exited I jabbed her right through her pants. Everyone did that. We stole the pins from home economics. It was normal, but it made tears roll down your face if someone did it to you. That diamonds are supposedly forever was something Jimmy Darling joked about. Every mineral here on Earth is forever, he said, but they make it seem like diamonds are especially forever in order to sell them, and it works. A few days later, Tyra called me, and we made a plan to go to Golden Gate Park on a Sunday to the bridge where people roller skate and hang out. Tyra came to my house since I lived a few blocks from the bridge. She said, I need to beat this bitch's face in. I said okay, and we went to the park. The girl whose face Tyra had an appointment to beat in was already there, with two older brothers. They were not from the Sunset. Later I learned they lived in the Hate. The brothers were adults, both mechanics at a garage on Cole Street. The girl, Tyra's opponent, was tall and delicate-looking, with a shiny black ponytail. She was wearing pink shorts and a shirt that said, Whatever. Her lips were tinged with the bluish effect of opalescent gloss. Tyra was athletic and tough. Nobody wanted to fight her. She and this leggy girl with a ponytail took off their skates. They fought on the grass in their socks. The socks softened nothing. Tyra threw a fierce kick, but the other girl grabbed her foot, and Tyra lost her balance and was on the ground. The girl jumped on top, pinned Tyra's chest with her own knees, and began punching Tyra in the face, alternating fists, left, right, left, like she was kneading dough, punching it down to size, punching it and punching it, dough that was a face. Her brothers shouted encouragement. They were rooting for her, but if she were losing, they would not have stepped in, I knew. They were there as believers in the honesty of a fight and the pride of fighting well. She punched and punched. Her arms seemed too skinny to carry any force on contact, fist to face, but eventually they produced their damage. It never occurred to me to jump in. I watched Tyra get pummeled. When the girl felt she had sufficiently made her point, she let up. She stood, retightening her ponytail, and pulled her shorts out of her ass crack. Tyra sat up, trying to wipe away her tears. I went to help her. Her hair was tangled. She was covered in dead grass clippings. I got a good lick in, she said. Did you see how I kicked that bitch in the chest? Both of her eyes were swollen almost closed. Her cheeks had turned to hard, shiny lumps. She had an open gash on her chin from the girl's ring. I got a pretty good lick in, she repeated. It was the best way to look at things, but the truth was, she had been brutally beaten up and by a prissy girl in a whatever t-shirt, an unlikely winner. Who was not an unlikely winner, it became clear the moment the fight began. The winner was Eva. I did not become friends with Eva that day, but later. Whenever that later was, a year maybe, the memory of her and her punches was undiminished. I knew something about her. Most girls talk a big game, and then they scratch and pull hair, or don't show up for the fight. I suppose you could say I traded Tyra for Eva, like I traded Ajax for Jimmy Darling. But in both cases, the first was there to lead me to the second. Life allows for assessments and reassessments, and anyhow, who wants to be stuck with a loser? Eva was a professional. One of those girls who always had a lighter, bottle opener, graffiti markers, flask, amyl nitrate, buck knife, even her own sensor remover. The device that department store clerks used to remove theft prevention clips from new clothes. She stole it. The rest of us ripped out the sensors forcibly before leaving the store with our stolen loot. A sensor in a dressing room was a giveaway, so we took them with us, crammed up under our armpits, which muffled the sensor, deadened it to the detection alarm, We were not kleptomaniacs. That's a term for rich people who steal by compulsion. We were finding innovative ways to acquire makeup and perfume and purses and clothes, all the normal things a girl would be expected to have and want, and which we could not afford. All my clothes had holes in them from where the sensors had been attached. Eva removed them from her stolen clothes properly with her magic device. Once, she walked right into iMagnon, clipped the wires from a rabbit fur coat with wire cutters, put it on, and ran for it. The wires fit through the arms of the fur and leather jackets, with large hoops dangling from the ends of the sleeves like giant handcuffs. Eva went through a tomboy phase and stopped wearing fur jackets. She dressed like one of the sunset guys, Ben Davis pants with a janitorial keyring dangling from a belt loop. The more keys on the ring, the better. It didn't matter if they opened anything except beer bottles. She wore a black derby jacket with the gold paisley padding on the inside, the trademark shoulder-to-shoulder seams. Like the boys, she completed that look with steel-toed boots for kicking people's heads in should the need arise. One night I encountered a group of guys sitting in the dark drinking 151 in Big Rec, older people I had never seen from Crocker Amazon, which was something like enemy territory. They wanted to show me Polaroids of Eva. "Is this your friend?" In the photos, Eva was passed out drunk and stripped of her tough kid uniform with a baseball bat between her naked thighs. Eva fist-fought guys and won. She one-upped everyone with drugs and drink. These boys with their photos, they knew what it meant to have done that to Eva, and they wanted me to see. I never told her, and even thinking of what happened later, Eva, a crack addict in the Tenderloin, the Polaroid photos with the bat, was still the worst thing that anyone had done to her. She did plenty to herself, but that is different. Some kids have a powerful drive to take drugs. They can't help it. Eva was like that. The first time she stole Valium from her mom, we each took one and went to West Portal. "I don't feel anything, do you?" she asked. "No, not yet. Let's take another." "I still don't feel anything, do you?" "A little. Let's take another." "Are you high yet?" "I'm not sure." We took the whole bottle and woke up several hours later with our faces warm from the surface of a sit-down Miss Pac-Man video game at Round Table Pizza. We both stumbled home and slept for 3 days. Not long after, I was at the bus stop on Laguna Honda, across from Forest Hill Station. It was midnight and the buses were on their late-night schedule, once an hour. There was one other person waiting, a man who offered me a cigarette and light, and then asked if I knew where he could get any pills. He was probably young, in his 20s, but at the time I didn't think about his age. Anyone over 18 seemed old to me. He knew how to talk to young girls, to flatter. I boasted that I could sell him some Valium. It was a lie. I was a 12-year-old whose friend had lucked into her mother's temporary supply. Still, I said I could probably get him some. "Can I buy them now?" he asked. I said I had to call my friend. He wanted to give me his phone number so I could call him after I spoke with her. Neither of us had pen or paper, and I secretly doubted I could get more Valium, but I was trapped in my lie. He took off his shoe. They were old men-type shoes, suit shoes, and he used the black heel to write the 7 digits of his phone number on the rough stucco of the retaining wall next to the bus shelter. I watched as this man, sweat-soaked on that cold night, scratched out his number on the wall with the heel of his shoe so that I could call him when I got what he needed, and I thought, what have I done? I usually wasn't planning on getting wrecked until Eva knocked. One morning she arrived with 2 hits of something called Delcort, which was acid and PCP mixed together. We each took one. That was in the summer after 6th grade, one more dull and foggy day with nothing to fill it, maybe play video games at Cafe Roma on Irving, get a piroshki, which was a donut stuffed with ground beef and American cheese, drink Dirty Socks ale called Mickey's in the Park, talk to the clerk at the comic book store, who told me what blue balls was. I was probably blueballing him by asking. To make that day different, We dropped the acid PCP mix and walked the streetcar tracks all the way to Ocean Beach. We stopped at 7-Eleven on Judah. I bought a Butterfinger and took a bite, and the candy bar turned to sand in my mouth. I thought, I hate my life. Later, we sat in a van in someone's garage listening to Slayer, and Eva threw her head back and closed her eyes, and I looked at her face and her long black hair in profile and was convinced the devil was in charge of the future, mine and Eva's, and that nothing could save us. That was before people started going to Anton LaVey's house, where everyone worshipped Satan together as a group. It was in the Richmond on the other side of Golden Gate Park. I never went there, but kids I knew did. You had to be from a conventional background to go full tilt into devil worship. My mother was an atheist and would have teased me if she thought I'd gone into religion, even a satanic one. The Norse, my future woodshop partner in Stanville, would have loved to get an invite to Anton LaVey's house. But she is in prison, and Anton LaVey's house is in the past. Anton LaVey is dead, and his black house is gone too, replaced by condominiums. The house that interested me more belonged to a group of people called the Scummers. Eva took me there. It was on Masonic near Haight, a typical rambling old Victorian building with the bubble glass bay windows that rattled as diesel buses passed by going down the hill. The 43 headed toward Sears on Geary, where we would lie down on the beds in the furniture department when we were tired. I didn't know anything about the Scummers, who they really were or how long they'd been in that large apartment. Inside, it had never stopped being 1969. Every room was painted with tennis balls. The balls were soaked in different colored paints and then ricocheted around the rooms, walls, floor, ceiling, a spaghetti strands riot of color that gave the place a sameness that was not at all calming. It was the scribbling of a brain in chaos projected up over the walls, a kind of ambient filth. Many non-family-related people lived at the Scummers, all of whom were part of a family business selling purple microdot. A huge woman sat in the kitchen parceling the microdot with a butcher knife into glassine baggies. The microdot did not go to waste. She apportioned the bags, and if you were there to buy, you sat at the table, and when she was ready, she looked up at you and took your money and gave you your bag. The first time I went there, a shirtless boy with a sleepwalker's vacated look stood behind her at the stove boiling water for macaroni and cheese. He was thin and lithe, with hair as blondly colorless as lice egg casings. He had a concave area in the center of his chest, a divot that made him even more ghost-like as he waited for his water to boil. The sound his dry noodles made sliding from their box gave me a bad feeling. He opened the cheese and powdered it into the pot. He ate from the spoon he used to stir the noodles. He was barefoot, and his pants needed a belt. He looked about 10 years old. Who were those people, the Scummers, and where did they go? A lot of history is not known. A lot of worlds have existed that you can't look up online or in any book, even as you think you have the freedom to find things out that I cannot, since I don't have access to the internet. Google the Scummers, and you'll find nothing, no trace, but they existed. And if someone did remember them, someone besides me, that person's account would make them less real, because my memory of them would have to be corrected by facts, which are never considerate of what makes an impression, what stays in the mind after all these years, the very real images that grip me from the erased past and won't let go. The bar in the Upper Haight, where Eva's mother spent her time, was called the Pall Mall. They let kids in the bar, and people bought us love burgers, which were just hamburgers, except you could get curry on the bun if you wanted it, and that part maybe was the love. A sauce that stained your hands a bright pollen yellow. Outside the bar, you gave what you weren't going to finish to Leatherman. Remember Leatherman? A lot of people from the Haight would remember Leatherman if you asked them about him. Leatherman wore black leather pants, a leather shirt, a black leather hat. His bare feet were sooted black from the streets. He stood outside the Pall Mall or wandered the park's eastern edge along Stanyan, a shoreline he sifted. It was littered not with shells, but trash from the McDonald's franchise across the street. Leatherman was rumored never to remove his leather clothes. He had not taken them off in decades. Once, as Eva's mother stood with us outside the Pall Mall, we watched Leatherman scrounge in a garbage can. Eva's mother said, "You girls know what'll happen if he takes those clothes off, don't you?" We shook our heads. "He'll die." She exhaled smoke and flicked her cigarette into the street in a way I later copied, off thumb and pointer finger, a tiny gesture that made me feel tough. Leatherman picked up her cigarette butt and enjoyed the last few puffs that Eva's mom was rich enough to part with. Leatherman was not to be confused with Liverman, but no one who knows about both would do that. Liverman rode the 71 Noriega. I saw him only once and knew immediately that this was the infamous person I'd heard about. A hard plastic form that looked somewhat like meat, like liver, was melted or molded to his head. It was the permanence of the thing, affixed to him, part of him, that made him a brutal sight. A thick, shiny slab attached where hair might have been, or a scalp. Someone said he was a Korean War vet, a veteran of some trauma which had resulted in the gluing of this object to the top of his head. The Shuffler was another occasional sighting. That was on the other side of the park, near the Baskin-Robbins on Geary, where I worked in high school. The Shuffler walked at a normal gait, and then suddenly his legs stirred into quick action, like he was a machine designed to buff the sidewalk, buff it with shoe soles. He slid and shuffled all the way down the block, paused, then went back to regular walking. It could have been a kind of disorder, a nerve thing, but it seemed like destiny. He was the man who broke into a shuffle on Geary and then broke out of one. Worked is a bit strong. We served ice cream and didn't punch in all the sales on the register, took the stolen profits at the end of the night when we tallied our drawer. We hit the nitrous oxide tank that was used to fill whipped cream canisters. Mostly girls were employed there, and we let boys skateboard around inside the store, go behind the counter, help themselves to the nitrous tank, and scoop their own ice cream. We slopped water on the floor at the end of the night to fulfill our duty to mop, after moving the clock forward to close early. Place was run by kids, unsupervised, because the evening manager, a Scottish alcoholic named Helen, left early every day after making the ice cream cakes, which was a specialized skill we did not possess. The man in the bus shelter on Laguna Honda who wanted the Valium? It was his pushy optimism that alarmed me, the insistence of writing down his telephone number on a wall with the heel of his shoe. He needed his drugs and was ready to do business with a 12-year-old girl. He needed to believe her when it was plain she was probably lying. Eva's mom was white. Her dad was Filipino. Her mom was a heroin addict. Her dad was strict. He worked for a security service that had him posted at the entrance of the gigantic old Lucky Lager brewery in Bayview, which had closed down. We went there once to get money from him. He crumpled it up and threw it at Eva and went inside the gates. A decade later, I was with some guys who broke into that place. My friend stole a bunch of equipment. One of them later returned with a rented backhoe to take machinery that was too heavy to lift. Eva's dad was retired by then. Eva was on the streets. Her mother was dead of an overdose. The Pall Mall was closed. The scummers were gone. The sunset was transformed. The grocery store on Irving was gourmet. A girl I was friends with in high school worked the meat counter. People who looked like frat boys crowded the streets, wearing college sweatshirts and sipping health drinks out of giant styrofoam containers. They even moved the old post office, which felt like a grievous insult. Everything got converted by money, and I started to miss these grim places that offered no happy memories, but I wanted them back. The bars with sticky floors and French tickler dispensers in the bathrooms, like the golden grommet, which we called the golden vomit, for the old Irish men who slept in its doorway, waiting for it to open at 7 a.m. I miss the lonely, unreliable streetcars, which now ding-dinged every 8 minutes and were full of people in expensive shoes with careful hair. The little shelter where I used to wait for the 44 on Laguna Honda had been fixed up. Gone was its piss stink and the pinkish-beige color of the retaining wall and shelter, which had been the same drab tone as the youth guidance center beyond the bus stop on top of the hill. YGC was called something else now, meant to seem kinder, more caring. The wall where the man had written with the heel of his shoe was painted over. But what if that wall would not have been painted over, if by some miracle the numbers the man scratched on rough stucco were still there, bleeding through time, numbers he wrote with a shoeblack from his heel? Who would answer that phone line? And where is that man now? Where is the boy who was stirring at the stove on Masonic, the young scummer? Where is Leatherman? And where is Eva? Where is everyone? And what has happened to them? Chapter 3. No orange clothing. No clothing in any shade of blue. No white clothing. No yellow clothing. No beige or khaki clothing. No green clothing. No red clothing. No purple clothing. No denim of any kind or color. No sweatpants or sweatshirts. No underwire or metal parts on brassieres. Ladies must wear brassieres. No sheer or see-through clothing. No layering. No exposed shoulders. No tank tops or cap-sleeved tops. No low-cut tops. No unnecessarily exposed body parts. No half-shirts or low-waisted pants. No logos or prints. No capri pants. No shorts. No skirts or dresses above the knee. No pants that are actually long shorts. No shirts without collars. All shirts must be tucked in. No jewelry. One tasteful wedding band is acceptable and will be inventoried by corrections officers at check-in. No piercings. No bobby pins or metal clips in hair. Hair must be tidy and pulled back. No shower sandals. No flip-flops. No sunglasses. No jackets. No overshirts. No hoodies nor any clothing with a hood. No tight clothing. Clothing must not be excessively loose or baggy. Appearance, hair, and clothing must be professional and in good taste. Those who arrive to a state facility in inappropriate attire will be turned away and their inmate visit canceled. Chapter 4. If his students could learn to think well, to enjoy reading books, some part of them would be uncaged. That was what Gordon Hauser told himself and what he told them, too. But there were days, like when one woman walked into the prison classroom and slung boiling sugar water into the face of another woman, that he did not believe it. There were days when it seemed like the real meaning of this work he was doing was to destroy his own life by trying to teach people who wanted to burn each other's faces off. The guards made everything more difficult with their hatred of the women and their hostility toward free world staff like Gordon. The guards had been forced to undergo sensitivity training and were furious about it. "It's because you cunts cry and demand explanations," they said. "Everything with you bitches is why." They all reminisced about the better times when they had worked in men's facilities, where they watched high blood volume stabbings on closed-circuit monitors from the safety of the watch office and dealt with prisoners who lived strictly by self-enforced convict codes. Female prisoners argued with guards and complained, and the guards seemed to find the way the women bickered with them, contested everything, more treacherous than having to subdue riots. No guard wanted to work in a women's prison. Gordon had not understood this until he got to NCWF, which he'd chosen because it was commutable from Oakland and because working with women seemed to him less threatening than a prison classroom of men. His first placement had been with juveniles in San Francisco. He did that for 6 months, but it was too depressing. kids in cages telling him stories about their foster homes, about sexual abuse, all kinds of abuse. Most didn't have parents, but some did. Gordon saw them in the court's waiting area before he passed through a sally port to get to his classroom. People with holes in their sweatpants, t-shirts advertising random logos, inadequate shoes, poor people with chaotic lives. Couldn't the juvenile judges see from looking at the guardians that the kids didn't stand any kind of fair chance? There were signs to pull up your pants because to wear them low was disrespectful. Gordon had a student who was always getting in trouble for having his pants too low, a big white boy whose eyes were spaced tight together in the center of his face. "You talk like you're black," a black kid had said to the white boy with his tight, stamped eyes, "but you look like you're retarded." "No bare feet," a sign at the building entrance warned, as if someone would try to come into a detention center and court, a municipal building on a bleak and windy corner, not close to the beach, without shoes. Another sign, "no tank tops." Under it, typically, an entire three-generation family, all in tank tops, flesh spilling. And what was it about shoulders? What was law enforcement's fear of shoulders? "To be in this place, you gotta be butt ugly, toothless, and fat as pull-apart buns," the yard captain at NCWF had told Gordon his first week there. As the yard captain said it, there were beautiful women passing behind him, porters with mops and brooms pushing trash bins on wheels, some of them thin and with all their teeth, young things smiling and winking at Gordon, as if the joke was on the yard captain, who was himself obese. There was one woman who immediately commanded Gordon's secret attention. Her brooding, childlike face and large dark eyes moved him. That was what beauty was, he supposed, when someone's face stirred feelings. She was always reading, her eyes cast down toward pages. More typically, the good-looking ones were overly aware of their beauty. It was something to which they subjected others, a thing they hawked, bartered, and controlled. Hauser had never been up for that kind of charade, in prison or in his other life, the real one, which was becoming less real to him. This girl did not know to use her beauty to manipulate, didn't even know she was beautiful, was Gordon's sense, and when he one day looked at her and kept looking at her, she glanced at him, and before she turned away, he saw fear, or what he thought was fear. He didn't know which unit she lived in. She'd been on yard crew, but they must have switched her because she wasn't out there anymore. A few times he saw her in the law library, working like every other prisoner on her habeas petition. Once in the chapel, praying with a little group, and once in receiving, waiting on a package, and he had felt irrational jealousy that she was being sent a package. By whom? A rival, probably a man. She was too pretty for the package not to be from a man. And if the package was instead from the girl's mother or sister, it meant she was not just Gordon's foundling, but someone's beloved relative. And the connection he imagined she and he might have would be overshadowed by her loyalty to other real people unknown to him involved in her life. NCWF stood for Northern California Women's Facility, but the guards called it No Cunt Worth 40K, which made it sound like these guards all faced a dilemma between their job and easy action with prisoners. In that fantasy, the guard pulled a slot lever by punching his time card and got either dollar signs in triplicate or cherries in a row. And if the guard pulled the lever and the cherries came up, it was for each man to have the strength of character, the good judgment to resist. "You got a lot of self-control, that's one thing I'll say about you," Gordon's father had said to him when he picked up young Gordon from the Martinez Public Library, which was bigger than their own tiny library in the town near the Carquinez Strait where Gordon grew up. His father was a metal fabricator and thought that anyone who could sit and look at little symbols on a page all day must be denying other impulses. But for Gordon, reading was his impulse. It made the world bigger. In high school, he fell in love with Dostoevsky, literature that matched his gloomy doubt. Dostoevsky was no belief in anything but the greasy, earthbound world where humans wandered, fought, corrupted, and killed. Then again, Dostoevsky was a Christian, and those who fought and wandered in his novels had lost their way, while God had not. Dostoevsky was something vast, universe-sized, a universe that had order, but not fixed and artificial Greek order. It was a scattered realm of chaotic trials, and Gordon knew he was stepping into the territory of truth when he read it. His father was dead now, and Gordon finally had the kind of job his father would have approved of, unionized with benefits. Gordon had never intended to work in a prison. There had been layers of resignation, attempts to stay in graduate school, the passing of oral exams on his second try, the granting of the midway point, the master's degree in English literature. But the dissertation that he had planned to write on Thoreau's image of a spiritual molting season, of a new man, the fateful concept of an American Adam, an idea Gordon was fond of because of its precipitous arrogance, and who doesn't want to change his life, be reborn, unfettered, and sinless? The whole pursuit had been a crushing source of stress. He and his advisor didn't get along. The more progress he made of the sort his advisor wanted, the less able he was to locate any passion for his own subject. He felt trapped into an impossible commitment. He had debt, and he was about to lose his teaching fellowship. He needed to work. He found an adjunct position at the local community college in Oakland. The job barely covered his living expenses and left him no time for his dissertation. Maybe that was its upside. He was free to not work on it. But the adjunct work was intermittent. Broke and somewhat desperate, he submitted an application for a teaching position posted by the California Department of Corrections. He interviewed. They wanted to hire him as a full-time teacher, and just like that, his stress over money faded away. His friend Alex filed his dissertation on Melville and went on the job market as an Americanist, even as Alex slagged Americanists, said they were a bunch of cornballs. Alex got the welcome reception, the interviews, the job talks. People called Alex the Wunderkind, even though he was the same age as Gordon and their other peers. Alex looked about 18, that was why. Alex knew how to behave around powerful people, presented the right blend of irony and deference. There were people from the department who took him under their wing, coached him, people who had never quite warmed to Gordon. Gordon went out of his way to remain friends with Alex. He wasn't envious, he told himself. Before he realized it, the days of teaching at NCWF were structured by whether he might get a glimpse of this girl he liked wondering about. She averted her eyes when Gordon looked at her. He pondered trying to talk to her. When Gordon made the discovery that she worked in cosmetology training, the chanciness of his days ended. There was a salon in cosmetology where staff could get haircuts for $12. He signed up and made sure to go when she was there. On the momentous day, he sat down, was draped by her right up close in an apron. The touch of her fingers to his scalp riveted him to the barber chair, setting off a chain reaction in his nerves. It could have been the case in the barber chair that day that he was hypersensitive to touch, since he had been alone for months. The corner of the comb, when the girl drew it along the part of his hair, sent a shower of tingles down his head and neck. He was a wiring diagram, lighting up. The touch of this girl's comb produced a feeling that was both terrific longing and something like longing fulfilled. "You have nice hair," the girl said. He had utterly normal and unexceptional hair, straight and brown. It was strange to Gordon how sometimes beauty was magnificent and other times it was nothing and did not move him. Her skin was bad, and the bad skin made her even prettier. It made her real. She wore the state-issue tennis shoes, bubblegums the girls called them, shoes that meant you were indigent, because if you had any hustle at all, you'd order brand-name sneakers from a mail-order catalog. She didn't seem to notice or care that she had no adorning marks of catalog supply privilege, of outside help. In Gordon Hauser's dream of her, the state blue clothes seemed to him almost like hospital scrubs, a nurse's clothes, not prison issue, the uniform of a person who takes care of others. And she did take care. She trimmed his hair, touched his head with her comb. There was something else. She was a black girl, but she spoke to Gordon like a white girl. She lived in the honor dorm and carried a Bible everywhere she went. That he associated her Bible reading with bookishness, maybe it was a confusion, but maybe not. Gordon started going weekly for haircuts. One day, the corpulent pig of a yard captain passed by in his club car as Gordon was walking toward cosmetology.
"You're going over there pretty often, aren't you, Mr. Hauser? Didn't I just see you getting a haircut last week?"
The yard captain and the other officers, many of them too fat to walk, reminded Gordon of the obese twins in the Guinness Book of World Records, twins in cowboy hats who rode mopeds to get from the bedroom to the kitchen. Gordon looked at the yard captain with mild contempt, and then beyond him to the woman he was there to see as she swept hair from the base of the last barber chair in the cosmetology school, the chair where he would sit, where she would soon be touching his head. Too fat to walk, and most of them brought in lunchboxes the size of traveling luggage. They were containers with collapsible handles and wheels, too big to lift and carry. What business of the yard captain's was it how often Gordon paid $12 to have his head touched by this girl? It was none of his business. He said to the yard captain that he guessed his hair must grow fast. The yard captain seemed satisfied that he had given Gordon a sufficiently hard time, made him a little nervous. The captain rode away in his club car, his huge ass like a sideways letter B in his military pants. Even people like Gordon's father, who owned few books, had a copy of the Guinness Book of World Records in their home. The prison library had several copies. It was a Bible for the bookless under God. That Gordon equated the thinness of his beloved with knowledge because the fat corrections officers were stupid did not occur to him until much later. In fact, he never really felt that to be the truth. It was everything together that had resulted in his infatuation, his own snobbery, his alienation from the military culture of the place, a physical attraction to the girl. All of it built a feeling in him, a kind of hope centered on her, the promise of something, but not what actually happened. There had been a girlfriend, Simone was her name, a teacher at the community college where he'd been an adjunct. She was nice-looking and plenty smart and didn't talk too much. Most people talked to fill silence and didn't know the damage they reaped. Simone spoke only when she had something to say, but he'd ended the relationship and there was sometimes no why. She'd liked him more than he wanted her to, maybe. He understood there were people who didn't want to be the wanter, but he could not make himself feel that way. As soon as a woman turned to Gordon with a look of need, he was halfway gone. He occasionally missed Simone, but every time, right after feeling a desire to see her again, he was always relieved not to have to deal with her. If she could just appear at certain exact moments, when he was horny or needed someone to talk to, that would have worked out fine, but people were not like that. There were hours built in where you had to hear someone express feelings about something that didn't seem important, and you nodded and pretended that it was. You had to mask your own ambivalence and pretend to be in love 100% of the time, and he'd rather swim in a lake of hellfire. The girl acknowledged their familiarity as if she knew why he came so often to get his hair cut, but she gave him no indication of her feelings. Other women called him cutie, taunted him to flirt. This one did no such thing. She cut his hair and avoided his gaze, answered his questions shyly, minimally. There was nothing in her body language that suggested they were flirting. This made the whole thing safe. It was limited to the feel of her comb on his scalp, her quiet breath, the slow, textured sound of scissors closing over wet hair, her fingers brushing clippings from his shoulders. Even despite his obsession with this girl, he sometimes wanted out of the prison job, but change was such an elusive thing. A man could say every day that he wanted to change his life, was going to change it, and every day the lament became merely a part of the life he was already living, so that the desire for change was in fact a kind of stasis that allowed the unchanged life to continue, because at least the man knew to disapprove of it, which reassured him not all was lost. As he was putting papers in his book bag one night, she came to his empty classroom with a program pass.
She was not a student in his class. She shut the door behind her. The room had a small observation window, but Gordon knew an officer would not walk past for another 10 or 15 minutes. He would like to say that nothing happened, especially because so little did, and he felt he was placed on the wrong end of justice. After she shut the door, she went close to him. Their lips touched. Yes, he kissed her, and not only. His hand grazed the front of her shirt, and then it grazed lightly between her legs, to see how she would respond, and the answer was in the correct manner, in the interested manner. And you might call that thinking, choosing, proceeding, but Gordon didn't. It was not thinking. They were pressed together, nothing serious, fully clothed, for a minute, maybe less. And then it was night count, and she had to get back to her unit. She filed a 602 inmate grievance, claiming that he groped her. This beautiful woman had targeted him. She did it, he later understood, for some complicated reason that had to do with the woman's girlfriend, who was his student. It was his word against hers. The investigative services unit contacted him, conducted interviews, and found nothing damning, but deemed him at risk of overfamiliarity. They advised he'd be reassigned to a different facility. They kicked him down the Central Valley like a can down a hallway, transferred him to Stanville Women's Correctional Facility, where no one but no one wanted to work. Chapter 5. You may decide to link my fate to the night I found Kirk Kennedy waiting for me, but I link it to the trial, the judge, the prosecutor, my public defender. This is what I remember of the day I met my lawyer, being put in an elevator that smelled of human sweat ionizing on stainless steel, the electric gloom of full-blast panel lighting, courtroom, room tone, slippers that said L.A. County on the side of each shoe. When it was time, the bailiffs directed me down a hall. They walked and I shuffled in leg irons to the long glass box in Department 30 where in-custody defendants see the judge. I was brought into the arraignment box, which had an opening at face level so defendants could speak to their lawyers. I had a full view of the courtroom. My mother was there. I was her daughter, and her daughter was innocent. Her presence gave me childish hope. When she saw me, she waved unhappily. A bailiff approached her and said something. No waving, probably. Signs in the courtroom said no lounging, no gum chewing, no sleeping, no eating, no cell phones, no children under 10 unless state subpoenaed as witnesses. In every courtroom where I had to sit, as my case wound through the system, I tried not to read them. You have to project unbearable remorse every second that anyone might glance your way, a juror or victim's relative, the judge. At every moment, you have to look like you can't live with yourself after what you have done. You can't look bored or hungry or tired. You can only look relentlessly guilty in order to seem possibly a little less guilty. I scanned for whoever might be my lawyer among the lawyers in the well before the judge's bench. My case was after the defendant next to me, a person the court was calling Johnson, Johnson versus the people. I was anxious to meet my attorney, but since he or she had not appeared, I watched as this Johnson tried to communicate with his lawyer, an old man with gray hair that flowed down his back. "My mom's a sheriff," Johnson said in labored speech. His face was wired so that he could barely open his mouth. He made throaty sounds like someone being gagged. "Mr. Johnson, your mother is a sheriff?" The old lawyer spoke in a fake, amazed tone. "Which division?" "Not mine. My girlfriend's. It's bail bonds." "Your girlfriend works at a bail bonds business? Then perhaps she's not a sheriff, Mr. Johnson." "It's her ma that own it." "Your mother-in-law owns a bail bonds business? What's it called?" "Yolanda's." "Located where, Mr. Johnson?" "They have it all over." "So she works at a branch of it?" "She own it, I told you, Yolanda." The prosecutor on Johnson's case appeared before the judge. He gleamed like something pressure washed. From that day forward, on every occasion that I was forced to spend in court, the prosecutors were consistently the most competent-looking people in the courtroom. They were handsome and slick and tidy and organized, with tailored clothes and expensive leather briefcases. The public defenders, meanwhile, were recognizable on account of their bad posture, their ill-fitting suits and scuffed shoes. The women wore their hair in short, ugly, practical haircuts. The men had various styles or non-styles of long hair, and every one of them was guilty of exceeding width limits on their ties. The buttons on their shirts dangled, ready to fall off. The prosecutors all looked like rich, well-rested Republicans, while the public defenders were overworked do-gooders who arrived out of breath, late to court, dropping loose papers that already had the waffle marks of shoe prints on them from having been dropped before. Me, Johnson, everyone here with state counsel, I felt like we were screwed, just absolutely screwed. Johnson told the lawyer he needed his high blood pressure medication. He was without his psych meds. He needed painkillers. He had chronic aches from a gunshot wound. He lifted his jail shirt and showed the lawyer. I couldn't see his chest. The lawyer reeled backward. My goodness, Mr. Johnson, it's amazing you're even alive. And what's the matter with your mouth? The old lawyer was yelling, as if Johnson was hard of hearing, while I looked on, tense and alert, because I was next. It's wired. My jaw broke. I'm a good citizen. I got a daughter. The lawyer asked when she was born. 1980. Mr. Johnson, I believe that's when you were born. The defendant, this Johnson, was 21 years old. Gunshot wounds, high blood pressure, chronic pain. He looked 48. I watched as the facts of his life were exposed like pants pockets pulled inside out. Okay, okay, Johnson said. They got me drugged. I'm sorry. Wait. I watched as he lifted his leg and awkwardly rolled up his pants with his chained hands. The daughter's birthday was tattooed on his calf. He read the date slowly, as if trying to decipher a historic plaque. The judge does not like residential burglaries, Mr. Johnson. Tell her I'm sorry, Johnson slurred through his wired jaw. In his own element, I wanted to think Johnson might be perfectly at home, a man on top of his game, whatever his game was. Life. On top of your game meant handling life, doing it right, being someone who inspired respect, someone loved by women and feared by enemies, and now torn away from what made him shine. Either way, Johnson was fully a human being, even if he could not remember when his daughter was born. After my own immersion in this new world of Johnson's, I knew why he had seemed so dim in the arraignment box. The assholes had given him an involuntary injection of liquid Thorazine. When certain types of inmates were slated for court transport, an involve by corrections officers made their own job easier. Drooling and high on unpleasurable brain dullers, these defendants did not present well before a judge, or before their own public defender, who talked to them like they were three-year-olds. When his arraignment was over, the bailiffs put on their blue rubber gloves for handling Johnson. He struggled to walk in leg irons. When they brought him past, the bailiffs held him as far away from their bodies as possible. Take it slow, one told him. They leapt out of the way when Johnson tripped. He fell on his broken face right there in the tank. No one helped him. His jumpsuit was brown, which meant medical. A county wristband indicated open wounds. He might spread bacterial infection or something worse. Defiance, depression, dyslexia, HIV, mental degradation, rotten luck. I was next, but nothing was happening. The judge left the bench. I sat for maybe 20 minutes. A bailiff behind me, no lawyer calling my name, feeling my mother's sadness, unable to meet her gaze, because if I did, this would be even harder. I inspected the eagle on top of the courtroom flagpole. The eagle hovered on the wooden flagpole as if what it had caught was the American flag that was attached to the pole. I have seen enormous flags ripple, strung high on towering poles. Car dealerships have them. Sometimes McDonald's have them, huge flags that fly for commerce and announce America. Here in this courtroom, the flags hung limp and still, collecting dust. A flag needs wind, I thought, just as the judge was announcing my name and case number, and then again my name and case number. I'd been told I would have my first contact with legal counsel at arraignment. I stood as the bailiff ordered me to, but no lawyer appeared. Johnson's lawyer, with the flowing gray hair, limped up to me. What does he want? I wondered. Miss Hall? Rami Hall? I'm your public defender. You can have sympathy for Johnson's lawyer if you must, but I don't have to. He meant well, but he was an incompetent and overworked old man. Got me 2 life sentences and failed to make admissible the whole sordid history of Kurt Kennedy and his obsession with me. Kennedy had fixated. He had made it his life's work to be outside my apartment building, to be in the garage where I parked my car, to lurk in the cramped aisles of my corner market, to follow me on foot and on his motorcycle. When I heard the motor of that cycle, which made a high-pitched whine, I flinched. He had a habit of calling me 30 times in a row. I changed my number. He got the new number. He came to the Mars room, or he was already there. I asked Dart to 86 him, and he refused. He's a good customer, Dart said. I was expendable. Men who spent money were not. Kennedy hunted me and didn't let up. But the prosecutor convinced the judge that the victim's behavior was irrelevant. It did not establish an imminent threat on the night in question, and so the jury never learned a thing about it, not a single detail. It was the judge who disallowed the evidence, but I blamed the lawyer. I blamed the lawyer because he was supposed to help me, and I felt he did not. Why can't I testify and explain? I asked him. Because you'll get destroyed on cross-examination, he replied. I can't let you do that to yourself. No competent lawyer would put you on the stand. When I asked again, he fired questions at me. About the work I did to make a living. About my relationship to Kennedy and other customers. About the decision I made to pick up a heavy instrument. About the fact, he reiterated, that I struck a man sitting in a chair, a man who could not walk without 2 canes. I tried to answer his questions. He tore my answers apart and made them into questions, and I tried to answer those, but struggled. When he asked another question, I screamed at him to stop. You will not take the stand, he said. What those 12 people knew was that a young woman of dubious moral character, a stripper, had killed an upstanding citizen, a veteran of the Vietnam War, who had sustained a job-related injury and was permanently disabled. Because there was a kid present, they tacked on a charge of child endangerment. Never mind that it was my child, and the person endangering him was Kurt Kennedy. Johnson's lawyer had tried to convince me to take a plea. I refused. I knew how the system worked, at least vaguely. Most cases never went to trial because prosecutors scared defendants into taking pleas, and lawyers encouraged that route for their own reasons of not wanting to lose a case. My situation was different. It had circumstances. Anyone who was there and knew the history would have understood what happened and why, although no one was or did. What I didn't realize at the time was that most people took pleas because they did not want to spend their life in prison. I never thought of him as my own lawyer. He was always Johnson's, even as I never knew Johnson or thought about what happened to him. He was just another body jammed through the system, a Johnson of thousands. Still, I liked Johnson. His girlfriend's mother was a sheriff, and to hell with anyone who questions that. In court, Johnson's lawyer kept saying, "Strike that," after half his sentences, "Strike that." Maybe it was normal, I didn't know, but every time he said it, my heart sank. The jury did not learn what Kurt had done to me. The tireless stalking, the waiting, the following, the calling again, the surprise appearances. None of it was to be spoken of in court. What the jury knew was that a tire iron was used. People's